So we've seen 6 episodes of the animated series now, and that's a small sample size. It's only a fourth of the show.
It's the kind they would give you in the grocery store.
Yeah, but I think we're well on the way to saying that this is a pretty good show.
I kind of have loved every episode I've seen. There's been something worthwhile watching in every single episode so far, and you can't say that for the original series. Now, obviously, the original series had a longer run, but I think, I don't know, every single one of these episodes has been awesome.
Yeah, I mean, some have been better than others, certainly, but yeah. I would say that of the 6 episodes we've seen so far, and we're going to be talking about The Trouble with Tribbles and later on The Survivor this week, that they are...
More Tribbles, more Troubles.
Yes, sorry. It's my okay. God. I got them mixed up.
The episode that will make you fear Tribbles.
Yeah, that is very true. That these are better than the 3rd season, I think, on average.
And even, like, the alternative factor was an earlier episode, and that was awful.
Oh,
like,
yeah, absolutely,
were,
yeah.
The early episodes of first season original series were worse than this. Now, of course, they were still trying to figure out tone, but...
I would disagree with you, because the Corbinite Maneuver, for example, was, I believe, the 1st or 2nd episode that was filmed. So,
really? Well, then... Fuck me, then.
Exactly. You don't know what you're talking about.
I have no idea about anything.
That's very obvious from the 40-something episodes so far that we have recorded of this show.
Look, you came to the show knowing that there was one guy who knew his shit and one guy who knew nothing, and I'm the know-nothing half. So, I mean, what do you expect?
And you're living up to your perspective there.
Hey, this is what I get paid for.
You get paid to do this?
Not
Where's
yet.
My check?
Well, you're the one who signs it, so...
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be waiting a while, then. And I, you know, it's funny. I think the animated series certainly is stronger than the original series when it first started, as you said. But I think some of that simply has to do with the fact that this isn't really the first season of something. Like,
yeah.
Many of the episodes that we've seen so far, I think 4 of them and perhaps 5, maybe even all 6 of them, I'm not sure, were all written by people that had written on the original series. And
these characters have been established.
And these characters had been established, and the show was really trying its hardest to stay true to what the original series felt like. I'm not willing to go so far as to say it's sort of a lost classic. I mean, a lot of people have given that kind of thing to it. I want to see some more of it before I say that. But it's certainly stronger than the 3rd season. And I think if you swap out the animated series for the 3rd season, maybe slotting in a couple of the really good 3rd season episodes like the Tholian Web
or the Blind Lady one,
none other ones.
I liked the Blind
I'm
Lady
I'm ignoring one. You. That you would have a really strong season of television. And I think, you know, the other thing too about the animated series is, you know, now that we have seen 6 episodes of it, there certainly are problems with it. I mean, and we'll see, you know, let's get into more troubles because, it's a decent episode. I think it's probably the worst episode of the show so far we've seen. And I think the reason for that is one of the problems with the show in general is a lack of energy. And what I mean by that is there's just the voice acting in it is very muted a lot of times.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of that just had to do with the fact that Filmation had a certain way they worked, which, and I was reading about this week in preparation for the show, where the stated reason for why a lot of the voice acting in the show isn't bad necessarily, but sort of sounds out of context, is the same reason that a lot of video game voice acting sounded so bad for so long.
Okay.
Is that you're basically given a list of lines to read, totally out of context. You're not given a script, so you really don't know what the scene is supposed to feel like.
So in other words, they took Shatner in the booth. They had, you know, for the first hour, Shatner's there, and he reads all of his lines in order, and then they have, you know, Michelle Nichols reads all of her lines, and so on and so forth, and they just kind of paste it together.
Exactly.
And that's obviously going to work very quickly then, because everyone's working in shifts. You probably one day to, you know, record it, another day to re-record and clean up, and
you don't need to worry about scheduling. You don't need to worry about having them all in the same place. You don't even need to have the actors in the same physical location from recording session to recording session. I mean, if, you know, Leonard Nimoy was doing a play in New York and then a month later he was back in LA, he could record in both places.
Yeah.
So it's very easy in that sense, but it does lend the show sort of a lack of energy that I think the original series really had. And it makes More Tribbles, More Troubles a less good episode than it otherwise could have been, because of course a lot of comedy is dependent on having a lot of energy, and this episode just doesn't have it.
Yeah, and I think we can't discount the fact that people like, you know, Shatner is obviously an extremely physical actor, so there is no way that him in a recording booth is going to be, well, I mean, I've heard his album, but beyond that, you know, he works much better when he's on a set and he's able to...
He has people to react to.
Yes, and that's just his acting style, so it does sound very, it sounds like a book on tape in a way.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But, you know, it's weird because I find, I don't know, I don't find that the problems detract from it, and I don't know if it's as simple as just I'm expecting much less from it, or I'm finding it charming in a you can see the zipper on the monster's, you know, costume kind of level. I mean, that may just be it.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're going to look at the animated series, I think you have to overlook the sort of lack of energy in the voice acting, and also just the quality of the animation. It's not very good. In the same way that you have to overlook some stuff in the original series. You know, you had some shoddy sets sometimes. Things didn't always look great. Certainly there were problems with production quality in some of the original series, especially in the third season. So I think in both cases, if you can look past those things, there's a lot to like in both of them.
And I would go so far as to say, in the animated series, because it is so crudely done, you know, you have to kind of imagine what it really looks like. And so that kind of helps fill in some of the holes in the original series. What you're seeing film, so
yeah,
it does look barer that way.
Now this episode doesn't have too many trippy visuals. I mean,
no.
Now let's go right out there. I mean, I think The Trouble with Tribbles is probably one of your favorite episodes of the original series. Is this a good follow up?
You know, watching it at the time, it felt a lot like the original episode. It had a very similar tone. It has pretty much the same plot. By them calling it Quinto Triticale is, you know,
I mean, admitting
it.
You've got that. You've got Sherman's planet coming back. The Tribbles, obviously. Koloth, who was the Klingon in the original Trouble with Tribbles episode.
It is very much a part two.
Exactly. And it was even written as a spec script for the third season.
Yeah.
And the producer did not like the Tribbles episode and did not like the comedic tone of it and did not want to do a Tribbles follow-up, which was a really stupid decision. And I think says a lot for why the third season of Star Trek was so bad.
Well, he was a stupid man.
There is, you know, certain things about the animation that I like. There's the Glommer creature.
Yeah, well, they're able to do, and they really go out with the creatures that they could not.
Yeah, the basic plot of the episode is that they're in the neutral zone or something, and they're trying to get these robot ships with this Quinto Triticale to Sherman's planet. Basically, the same setup as The Trouble with Tribbles. And they encounter a Klingon ship which has this new weapon. It's a stasis field, which I like. There's another ship that they're rescuing, and it turns out, of course, that it's Cyrano Jones.
Oh, what a bastard.
And he has a tribble.
Oh, no.
And he has developed some sort of tribble-eating monster called Glommer.
Well, he has the... these are super tribbles, which he claims will not reproduce. And anyway, he's made... Yeah, he has this little creature, and it's... How would you describe it? Like it's a nifty little creature.
It's basically like a mouth on legs.
Yeah. Which again, you wouldn't be able to really make a prop of that easily, or it would look weird. You'd have
sort of the puppet things from Cat's Ball.
Yeah.
And that would just not work.
Yeah. Although I do love those. Because I still can't figure out what they are. It was just such a random moment.
Yeah, don't even try.
Anyway.
Let's just pretend Cat's Ball does not exist.
Pretend what does not exist?
Exactly.
Robert Bleck, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, so these tribbles, as it turns out, they don't reproduce, but they're getting bigger and bigger. And so you have these gigantic tribbles until you have the end revelation where you realize they find out they're colonies of tribbles. And then suddenly I'm thinking of tribbles as gigantic furry tumors.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
Like, this episode makes me think like tribbles are like cancer in pet form, and I'm a little terrified of it.
They kind of are. I mean, they breed exponentially and out of control. You can't control it at all.
Except with that Glommer, which is more horrifying than the disease itself may be.
So is the glomer in this analogy chemotherapy? Okay. All right. I think I might be stretching it a little bit, but we'll go with it.
Or like a radical mastectomy or something like that. Like just in general treatment.
There is that great thing line at the great scene at the very end where we're on the Klingon ship. And again, you know, the show does do things in this episode that it couldn't do. I mean, like I said before, the trippy visuals in this episode are not really there except for the glomer, but you know, the stasis.
Well, the pink tribbles are a.
Well, the pink tribbles were a mistake, actually.
Oh, no.
Because apparently the director, Hal Sutherland, was colorblind, and so he saw gray as pink, and he didn't realize it, which is also why some of the Klingon uniforms are pink.
Yeah, but there's nobody else who knew that, and why would you become a animation director if you're colorblind? Anyway.
It doesn't matter. Just go with it. That, you know, we get to see the inside of the matter-antimatter nacelles on the Enterprise, which is cool, and that's something they could never do on the show. We get to see, like, more of the interior of a Klingon ship. Again, they just didn't have the money to build budgets. You know, it's nothing revelatory, yeah. But it's interesting to see. So at the very end of the episode, when we're on the Klingon ship, there's a gigantic tribble, and of course, one of the visual gags in the episode is that the tribbles get bigger and bigger and bigger throughout the episode until the very end when they're like the size of an elephant. And the Klingons let the glomer loose. The door opens, reveals a huge Klingon the size of, tribble. You know, a rhino or something. Tribble, yes. And the glomer runs away like a mouse.
Poor little guy. And then he died.
I don't know if he died.
And then all of the tribbles ate all of the Klingons. And then, like, years later on an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, the animated series, like, they find this husk of a thing.
That doesn't exist.
And it's... Well, Oh.
Yeah.
I like, you know, there are a few great lines in this episode. Scotty is Scotty. And I love the part when Spock is... You know, saying, well, the weapon will hit us in 4 seconds, and he's just babbling on about the thing while it hits them. Like, it has some good moments.
And also, you're ignoring the best visual gag of them all, which is the tribble, which is growing increasingly larger in Kirk's chair, and he has to knock it out each time.
And eventually he just gives up on it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and his voice acting is not terrible, I would say, but it definitely...
It was fun. I had, you know, at the end of the day, every episode I've had fun watching.
Yeah, they're fun episodes. You know, like I said, I think the comedy in this episode is not as strong as The Trouble with Tribbles just because it's animation. And I don't know, it's not, you know...
And cheap animation, the pacing of the show is a little lackadaisical.
Yeah.
But, again, it's a very cheaply done show, but... It feels very cobbled together in an endearing way.
What did you... Do you have any thoughts on the Klingon stasis weapon, which we never really see again?
Well, like, I'm curious, because they're all like, well, you know, if we and the Klingon ship if it's using the stasis beam, then we both have drain power, and what can anyone do? Well, that's useless. And then, you know, nobody said, well, then another Klingon ship comes and just like... You know, like, all you need is for one side to have two ships.
Right.
And it's very easy for ships to travel in pairs, I would say.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't do that. That's a good point.
Yeah. I thought that would be one of the twists, is that, like, they're wondering, you know, well, how is this? And then, you know, another Klingon ship comes from behind. Like, that could have been a moment.
I suppose it's, you know, just one of those things where it's a prototype weapon and they're not really sure how it's going to work. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but if I could think about that tactic, don't you think that a bunch of military race society would have thought of that? Maybe it's a bad tactic.
But the author of this episode probably did not.
Well, then it's badly written.
Yeah.
Ugh.
The hell with him.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it was a fine episode. It was a 5 tribble episode. Maybe 6.
Yeah, I mean, it was okay. I like a 4 for me. Again, it's just...
You know, for just a dumb, funny, I was surprised by a tribble episode. To just have a tribble episode out of nowhere that I didn't expect, it made me laugh a few times. I mean, that's what I got from this.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's just for me, it's not as strong an episode as The Trouble with Tribbles.
No, and certainly.
It's not as it's the weakest episode of the show we've seen so far.
I can go with this.
It's certainly fine. I don't think it's bad. It's entertaining. But at the end of the day, it's a 4 tribble episode for me.
Well, good.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next episode, The Survivor. So to follow up a sequel to The Trouble with Tribbles, we now have a semi-sequel to The Man Trap.
Yes, but a better
Call one. The Survivor. This is a much better episode than The Man Trap.
Yeah.
And it's a much better episode because it actually feels like Star Trek.
Yeah.
I mean, if I recall correctly, and The Man Trap, I think, was the in the second episode of Trekabout, it was a very problematic episode because we had a sentient creature which was needing salt to survive and was loose on the ship.
And was explicitly the last of its kind and knew it was the last of its kind.
Right. And could assume the form of anybody on the ship. There was no attempt to communicate with the salt creature, and there was no attempt to not kill it.
Yeah. At one point, I think Spock briefly says, well, it's a living being, but, you know, that gets kind of dismissed. And
yeah.
It's a little tragic that they killed it at the end, but that's about it.
And in this episode, we have a creature which is not violent necessarily, but is that same shape-shifting creature, and they actually do try and communicate with it, come to some sort of agreement, and at the very end of the episode, it's all very happy, and they have not killed it, which I think is very nice.
You know, every episode so far I've noticed they do manage to either, you know, make friends with the villain or, you know, the first episode where they abandoned this, you know, creature on this planet was actually seems tonally different from the rest of the episodes we've seen. And even there, it left us with a feeling of pity towards this creature. So I almost,
Beyond the Farthest Star you're talking yes, about. Yeah.
I almost wonder if, you know, it feels like a very Saturday morning cartoon mandate to not be able to kill the villain and you have to, you know, convert it at the end. But at the same time, that's one that goes very hand in hand with the feel of Star Trek.
Yeah. The thing that I'm struck by in watching the animated series so far is how nicely the Star Trek philosophy slots into a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, nonviolence, trying to understand other species, trying to understand life, respecting life, coming to nonviolent conclusions and resolutions to problems. You know, these are all things that we see in Saturday morning cartoons all the time. Well, I don't know so much about now, but certainly in the 70s we did. And when television was supposed to be ostensibly much more educational than it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, we have My Little Pony now, for God's sake.
Yeah, My Little Pony in the 80s.
This is the 70s.
No, it's 2013, Eric.
And so I like that. I think it works. It certainly doesn't feel like the show is neutering itself in any way. And I, you know, I can't speak to whether or not NBC was it NBC this was on or CBS? Maybe it was ABC. Well, anyway, it was one of the three networks that I don't know that they were putting any restrictions on the show. I assume that they probably were, especially yeah. since it was a Saturday morning children's cartoon, but it works and it doesn't feel like the show has any restrictions placed on it. And I think this episode is a perfect example of that.
Well, I would say this episode makes the peaceful options seem more, it's much more interesting in the way they frame it. So they have this alien that's around the ship. And again, you know, animation that's this tentacle weird. It almost looks like a virus in a way. Like, it's this very strange-looking creature.
It's called a Vendorian.
A Vendorian. Yeah. Voiced by Ted Baxter.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And with, like, the best 70s mustache and, like, suit in the world.
Yeah, he's playing a character called Carter Winston, who is supposed to be some sort of, like, Federation, I don't know, Warren Buffett.
He's, like, the coolest guy in the world. Like, everybody loves him.
He's rich.
He's dripping with money, and he uses it all to help out the Federation.
Yeah, right? The setup for the episode is that they find him on a planet, and they're all in awe, and they're very excited to meet Winston Carter, and, you know, he's used his great fortune to help Federation colonies,
yeah.
which is what they say at the very beginning of the episode.
Yeah,
but then, of course, it turns out that he's not Winston Carter, and he's actually a Vendorian who is a Romulan spy.
Yeah, so they have this Vendorian hijacks the ship, takes it into neutral space. I love how the Romulan, you know, Kirk is saying, well, you know, it's an accident. We got hijacked, and the Romulan, who does know full well what's going on, but he basically says, yeah, well, it's always a mistake with you, which this is not the first time that Kirk's been in the neutral zone. It is very plausible that, you know, every single time he's gone there on purpose, you know, with the Romulan should not believe him. By this point, there isn't anybody who would say, yeah, you know, Kirk, is crying wolf a couple too many times.
I think that's probably true. I mean, especially since the last time we saw the Romulans was the Enterprise incident, and Kirk and Spock were on a secret high-tech mission to steal the cloaking device from the Romulans. I don't think that they're that willing to believe Kirk at this point.
Yeah, that's very open knowledge among the Romulans at this point that, you know, Captain Kirk did the last time.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Romulans in the episode are sort of incidental to the plot. They're not really there for any specific reason other than they needed a reason to have the episode happen.
They just need a generic villain that's...
It could have been anybody.
It could have been the Klingons. It could have been a different race. But, you know, Romulan was a nice tie back and...
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it turns out their plan is to want the Enterprise, to get the Enterprise, which... Having that be the Romulans' goal at this point in time is actually kind of a nice recurrent thing, because when they had in the Enterprise incident, you know, they were saying, oh, we've got the Enterprise, we're going to study it, you know, that is going to give them a massive tactical advantage. The two of Romulans and the Federation are very obviously in an arms race, and so they have a vested interest in getting each other's tech. I thought that was kind of a nice... you know, recurring element.
It certainly makes sense.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, I mean, they do say at the very end of the episode when they're demanding that the Enterprise is handed over to them that the treaty stipulates that if either side violates the neutral zone and they find out that they can seize the ship. I don't really know why the Federation and the Romulans would agree to that. That seems weird, but...
Yeah, it's a crappy thing, but else... Maybe that was just one of those stipulations that's how severe they're taking it, because again, neither side wants the other to have their ship.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it's basically, you know, saying, yeah, if you go into our country, you get to kill your president, you know? Yeah, well, I really don't want that happening, so we're not going to get caught, you know?
Except for Kirk, who's a hotshot and will just do whatever he wants.
Yeah, well, the president's a dick.
Do you think that the love interest angle in this episode works?
I think it's a very interesting angle because it... So every time there's been an energy being on the show who's assumed human form, the temptation of the flesh is always too great. And, you know, even when you have a benign alien, as in the Blind episode... It very specifically says, like, you know, it will get corrupted by, you know, seeing through another person's eyes. In this episode, now the Vendorian is obviously not an energy being. It does have a physical form, but they make the point that the longer that it stays in a person's form, the more it will actually start to think like that person.
Which is how we get the very end of the episode when Winston... is being sort of, you know, Kirk could punish the Vandorian, but he decides not to. And Carter says that thing about, well, I may actually want to live as Carter.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, we can rekindle our relationship at some point.
Yeah, well, it gives the Vandorian a very different character, because at the beginning it says it's, and I don't remember what the phrasing that it uses is, but it basically says that it was an outsider in Vendorian society.
Right, because the Vendorians, I think Spock says that they're supposed to be very manipulative and very sort of non-trustworthy and those kind of things. And this Vendorian, who I don't believe actually gets a proper name.
No.
But like you said, he's seen as an outcast, and he doesn't really fit into Vendorian society. And I think what we're supposed to take from that is either that, you know, and the reason why he can assume Carter's shape is because he nursed Carter back to health as much as he could, but Carter eventually ended up dying. So I think we're supposed to get the sense that this Vendorian is more altruistic than the rest of them, which is why he can fit better into...
I'm not sure. I don't know if it necessarily does matter or not. But either way, you know, the Romulans do come down and they basically find a use for him. I feel the Vendorian doesn't really have a place in society.
I think it does matter, because we have a character who's set up as someone who doesn't fit into his own society and is looking for a way out and will latch onto any way.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode, and of course he latches onto the Romulans because the Romulans are there, and he's spying for the Romulans. He takes on the form of Kirk. He's the one who causes them to go into the neutral zone in the first place. Let's not forget that. all as a prelude to set up this. This was the Romulans' plan to get the Enterprise. And at the end of the episode, he has a choice. I mean, the Vendorian could go with the Romulans, but he decides to go with the Federation, I think, because his personality fits better with the Federation.
Well, at this point, number one, he has been in the Winston position, and he is starting to, it said, he's starting to act and think like him. And so, you know, one of the characters on the ship who is a security officer, she is his fiance. And, you know, staying in this man's form, he does begin to genuinely feel the same feelings that he did towards her. And so, in a way, feeling human emotion does kind of tame him because, and he, I think he, by the end, he is realizing that while the Romulans found a place for him, but they're using him. He's just kind of a tool to them. And in the Federation, he has in more of an actual place. He would have people who actually, now, of course, he has to do that by changing into a different person completely, but I would say it's a,
well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I think that all the evidence points to he's doing that not because the Federation would not be, the Federation citizens would not be comfortable with the actual form that he takes, but more that at this point he's lived as Carter so long that he has almost become Carter, yeah, in a way, and he feels more comfortable as Carter.
Yeah, better to be, you know, in Vendorian form, in Vendorian society. He's an outcast. Here he belongs.
Right, right.
So, you know, either way, it is very, you know, they do find, he does find redemption through love, through a human connection. And, you know, the implication is that he is going to have to go to trial because he did do something wrong, whatever the reasoning was. But at the same time, Kirk will be vouching for him and he will get as light of a sentence as possible.
He's going to go to the dilithium mines for 3 months and then he's going to be out.
Exactly. And then assumedly he will be right back into helping the Federation in the same way he did.
Yeah. One thing the episode never really clarifies, though, is would the Vendorian have access to Carter's fortune? Because that seems a little strange if he would.
I mean, even if he doesn't, he is still Carter Winston in thought pattern, and he can, you know, he does still have those, we assume he's inheriting his business skills.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
He could come up with a way of, you know, doing something. Perhaps even when finding, or perhaps even maybe he left all of his fortune to the fiance or something like that. You know, she could have had some kind of, you know, been some, a recipient of something in the business, and that's how he's getting back access to the fortune. I think this is such an esoteric topic.
Well, I don't think it's esoteric at all. I'm getting a crazy Star Trek theory, which I'm sure you'll be very happy
to
hear.
Oh, boy!
About. In the original series, and I think in the animated series, very explicitly, because they actually say that this guy is rich and is basically buying help for Federation colonies, and why Starfleet isn't doing that, I don't know. And by the time of The Next Generation, of course, Picard is running around explicitly saying that they don't use money anymore, and their whole society is founded on the premise of doing whatever you want and you know, bettering yourself as a person. I don't know if it's a you know, post-scarcity society, but it's close enough.
Well, yeah, food replicators, and yeah.
I mean, you need to get the energy from somewhere, of course, and where do you get it from? I don't know, fusion reactors or something.
Yeah.
That maybe the Federation didn't like the fact that they were so reliant on a wealthy benefactor to take care of their colonies for them, and so completely restructured their economic system so that nobody could have money.
You know, that does make sense in, I mean, we're led to assume that Carter Winston is genuinely altruistic, that he is genuinely stepping in times of disaster. Anytime we see the Federation, an episode ending with, you know, well, the Federation will come down here and we'll help you reestablish your, you know, they're doing that on Carter Winston's dime. You know, he is probably paying for that kind of disaster relief. I mean, he is doing a genuine thing, but they could be in, let's say Khan had a fortune and was giving money to the Federation. You know, you don't want to be beholden to certain people.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even if they are as altruistic as Carter is.
Exactly. Again, for Carter Winston's sake, I don't think the money comes with any bad strings, but there are people for whom it might.
Yeah, that's
maybe
true.
Maybe that's why we see the Federation admirals being, like in the, you know, trial episode, why he was being so stubborn. I wonder whose pocket he was in.
Just a couple of the little things I like to mention about this episode. Maress has a line, which is nice. The cat lady.
Oh, yeah. I love the cat lady.
And she even has this sort of little purring thing going on.
It was pretty freaky.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, and she's also wearing a skirt, which fine. And
I'm sure a lot of internet artists have gotten a lot of.
I don't even want to think about it. Just drop that conversation entirely right now. Moving right along. Also, in the animated series, we got our first classic three-man joke ending.
Yes!
Because we have Spock, Kirk, and McCoy on the bridge.
And we have probably Spock's best burn.
Yeah. Well, why don't you give it to us?
Well, McCoy is basically saying, you know, it's good that he didn't spend more time as, you know, Spock, because we wouldn't have been able to deal with, you know, two of them running around. And Spock says, well, if we had two McCoys, we finally have a competent medical, you know, level on this ship. And it's like, good for you for turning it around.
Yeah. Spock can give as good as he gets, really.
Yeah.
I will give this one. Well, I don't know. What are you going to give it?
I'm going to give it 7 tentacles.
I'll give it 6 tentacles.
6 tentacles.
I like it. I certainly like it better than More Trouble, More Tribbles.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next week, we are going to talk about the Infinite Vulcan.
Ooh.
And the magics, with a K, of Megas 2.
Oh, do you remember we had that theory where, like, the worse the title was, the worse the episode was?
We will find out.
We'll find out.